Stories about outbreaks of contagious diseases make the news with some regularity, often with details about people getting sick who did not get vaccinated against the disease. Vaccine resistance is one of the stories of our times, and our next guest examines how it has been portrayed in public and in the news media. She finds some issues there. Bernice Hausman's book is called Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Bernice Hausman chairs the Department of Humanities at Penn State's College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania. She's the author of three previous books and our guest. Bernice, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
I can imagine vaccines are a frequent discussion topic in medical school. I imagine there's a hearty debate going on there.
It's interesting. The students in the first year class, Penn State College of Medicine, when they came to their first set of courses in a two-week period called Transitions to Medicine, they have these cases that they study in what's called problem-based learning, and one of the cases was a case of measles. So they try to, I think, keep the education timely, and it was very interesting for me to participate in that that teaching event.
I can imagine. But now, as far as the book goes, you spent, it looks like, 8 years researching this, and you found some seriously contrasting visions of human life and the vulnerability of bodies, it would appear.
Yeah, so I started this project in 2010, and I started it in part because I wanted to understand why friends of mine were nervous about vaccinating their children. But I also started it because I wanted to start a team-based collaborative research group with students. And I thought this would be a topic that students, pre-med students that I was teaching at the time at Virginia Tech, would be interested in. And so, initially we thought we would just be studying, you know, people who refused vaccines, and what we thought of at the time was their crazy ideas. And I quickly learned to think differently about the problem by the research that my students did to uncover some really fascinating historical themes and long-standing concerns about vaccination, and also really delving deeply into the philosophical issues, in some ways you could say existential issues, that emerge when you take vaccine dissent seriously.
It's interesting, too, because the research effort you talked about would be started as the Vaccine Refusal Research Group, and you changed the name, and it sounds like because of the research.
Well, and I think really what it came to was the realization that it's not possible to study a controversy by only studying a group of people that you predetermine to be incorrect.
Huh.
It's just not a responsible way to approach the research. You can still, you know, retain a critical perspective on the views that you analyze, but that as a starting place, it's not really very effective.
You point out in the book that your father was a physician and you grew up in the baby boom generation when there was quite a wave of vaccinations just coming into being. Was it ever a question for you to get your own two kids vaccinated?
So that's really interesting. No, my kids were born in the mid 1990s, and I was not aware at all that there were any concerns about vaccines. The main concern that I had vaccinating my children was how much they would cry when they got their shots, and there was this momentous moment when my daughter got her pre-kindergarten shots, which included that second MMR dose, I remember her fussing and screaming and. But it was, she was saying, I have to wear Band-Aids, and that was the sort of the trauma of the moment. But it was interesting because I was a member of La Leche League. I was doing research on breastfeeding at the time, and I was a breastfeeding supporter. And those were some of the groups where vaccine dissenting views can percolate. And yet, for some reason, they did not really enter into my social networks at all until after 2000, when I hosted a baby shower for a friend of mine, and one of the gifts that she received was were two books that discussed delaying vaccines for children. And that was really the first time I saw in my own social networks a set of concerns about vaccinating children.
And was it a few more years before you started the vaccine research group?
Yes, because I was finishing up at that time my second book on breastfeeding, which concerns contamination and contagion with respect to human milk, specifically looking at HIV transmission through breastfeeding, but also at all of the other concerns that we have about what comes out of mothers' bodies and goes into babies. So that's a theme that continues in the vaccination research, this concern about the infant body and what we do to the infant body to make it a cultural object and an appropriate member of our community. But I was finishing up that project right around 2009, 2010 when I started to think about vaccination.
So, Bernice, ultimately, did you write this book or start the whole effort that led to this book because you think society is harder on the anti-vaxxers?
Well, I started it because I study medical controversies in the public sphere, and I try to excavate the social elements of those controversies and demonstrate the anxieties or concerns that they represent on a very big scale. And so I came to think that that vaccination controversy is perpetuated by misunderstanding what vaccine dissenters are concerned about, by inappropriately narrowing those concerns to simply a problem about MMR and autism when it's much larger than that, and also this very troublesome tendency in news media now to resort to inflammatory discourses, and I think to resort to quick fix reporting that identifies villains and heroes rather than examining the complexity of circumstances of both vaccine dissent and infectious illness in the world today.
It stands out, but you made it stand out using italics in the book to say that there are already arguments that explain voluntary non-vaccination. What do you mean there, Bernice?
Well, one of the things that I try to do is connect up vaccine dissent and the various forms of vaccine dissent with other prominent cultural trends that that many of us who vaccinate engage in or believe in. So, for example, concern about contaminants in the environment and contaminants in our food and contaminants in our medicine. So that's a very strong concern in vaccine dissent. Distrust of pharmaceutical companies and the research that they conduct to demonstrate safety and efficacy of medications and including vaccines. Distrust of the government and its protection of citizens against threats to our health, and its cozy relationship with big pharma, as some people might say. And then another concerns about the earth and the things that we're doing to the earth and to ourselves in the name of health that may end up actually being dangerous to our health. Those are all very broad ways of talking about concerns that many people share, and those concerns weave themselves through vaccination dissent.
Do you find some strange bedfellows in here? People who, you know, talk about, you know, I want to make sure I eat organic foods. I want to make sure I don't put anything bad into my body. But of course, I get my kids vaccinated.
Yeah, that's a very common. I mean, there's a kind of a common set of stereotypes about the people who don't want to vaccinate. That they are, in fact, very affluent, educated, focused on organic foods. We do actually have themes in the research subjects we interviewed, you know, with significant emphasis on nutrition, for example, in that population. But one of the problems is we actually don't have a really good sense of vaccine concerns across the population because we have this very narrow conceptualization of what is a real concern and who has it. So, for example, one of our stereotypes is that this sort of white, educated, highly affluent mother who doesn't want to vaccinate her children because of potential harms. But in fact, the Pew Charitable Trust did a study in 2015 and found that people with lower levels of education actually had a higher concern about the measles vaccine. So that suggests that we're not doing a very good job actually matching up who we think has concerns about vaccines with who really does.
So the stories don't match the actual demographics as people have researched them.
Right, and one of the reasons for that is that we rely a lot on people who get exemptions from vaccine mandates, but it takes a lot of sort of nerve chutzpah resources to get those, to make sure that your child, especially in states where the vaccine, the exemptions are difficult to attain, to make sure your child gets them. And so people with resources tend to be the ones with exemptions. There's some concern that poor parents are not, and especially poor single parents who may rely on state aid, are in a difficult position in articulating their concerns about vaccines because they have concerns about how they're perceived by authorities.
So I mentioned already the baby boomers, how they really essentially grew up with vaccination. So many were new on the scene, like the polio vaccine. You say there was never a golden age of vaccine acceptance, though.
Right. So a lot of people pull out polio as this, you know, grand experiment in federally subsidized vaccine research and vaccine dissemination, and they show pictures of all these children lining up as polio pioneers, you know, because they did the trials on children in the United States. But there's a misunderstanding, and of course, many, many parents volunteered their children to be part of that that trial that demonstrated the effectiveness of the Salk and the safety of the Salk vaccine in 1954 and 1955. But many hundreds of thousands of parents held their children out and did not allow them to be part of the experiment. So my point there is just to say that not everybody, you know, was on board with allowing their child to be part of that experiment. And then there's a historian, David Oshinsky, who wrote a great book called Polio, An American Story. And he talks about this, and public health historian James Colgrove talks about this right after the polio vaccine was then licensed. And in the United States, there were concerns that people weren't taking it up. So parents weren't taking their children in to be vaccinated at the levels that people wanted them to. So the point there is not that parents, most parents were against vaccines, but just that there have always been people who have dissented from mass vaccination.
That was a great phrase, though. You kind of snuck in at the end there, the levels that people want them to. The fact is that the vaccine compliance is really high. I mean, when you consider things like, you know, how many people vote for president, for example. I mean, nobody ever gets 85 to 90%, but we're talking 90% plus on most of these vaccines, right?
Yeah. And so now that's a national number. If you drill down to the states, it's a little bit more variable. And then if you drill down to the local level, you do have these pockets of under-vaccinated children, especially, and those are the areas of susceptibility, because once a infectious disease kind of catches on in an area of under-vaccination, you do have the problem of outbreaks. And we saw this with respect to measles this year. We saw some very large outbreaks of measles in New York City and in Rockland County, New York, where there were large groups of under-vaccinated children in Orthodox Jewish communities. But what's really interesting about the sort of very large number of measles cases in the U.S. this year is that they were largely contained to the areas where they initially emerged, so that you actually had very successful public health efforts that contained them within those communities where there were these pockets of under-vaccinated children. So I think it's a success of public health, and I think we should be crowing about that, given the numbers of measles cases that are skyrocketing around the world today. And in the U.S., we maintain these high rates of vaccination largely through school entry mandates that are state-level laws that require children to be vaccinated against certain diseases before they're allowed to enter school.
Bernice Hausman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. Now, you do provide some charts and figures in the book, including early on the major vaccinations that are out there now for kids, which is quite a longer list than the boomers got, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, so it's sort of astronomically larger, the number of shots that children get these days. And that's a point of contention for many parents. There's a strong set of concerns about the number of vaccines that children can get in an individual visit to the doctor or health clinic. And there's also a set of concerns about the total number of shots that they get over infancy and childhood. Now, the story from mainstream medicine is that these number of antigens, which is the sort of active material in the vaccine that promotes an immune boosting response, that those are actually lower now given the sophisticated way that vaccines are made. From even when children had fewer vaccines, they received sort of fewer antigens in the whole set of vaccinations today, and also that they're safe, right? That the safety data to date has demonstrated that this high number of vaccinations is nevertheless safe. My sense is that we may be hitting what I would call the social limit for the number of vaccines that parents will tolerate for their children.
I've noticed that as well, that people complain about the number and the close spacing in particular, and how many a child will have by the time they're just 6 months old.
That's right. That is a concern, and it's one of those concerns that feels to be impervious is the wrong word, but it's almost there. It's that sense that my kid is getting too many vaccines is resistant to the counter argument that they've been demonstrated to be safe. So there's something about the experience of taking a child in and having them vaccinated that makes parents nervous about the number, even if scientists and physicians are saying that we've demonstrated that this is safe. And it's that kind of element of the controversy that I'm interested in. So what makes a sensibility or an experience that people have resistant to persuasion with biomedical evidence?
Well, and you do tell of some of the wilder claims about vaccine history, you know, many of them debunked but still defended. But aside from the studies done and refuted, now what about studies not done? I mean, are there numerous studies on how these vaccines all work together when given in close spacing like they are?
So I do not believe that they do active sort of, you know, those sort of randomized controlled trials of those kinds of studies, in part because the belief that the vaccines are so important that it's not possible in the country today to sort of do that kind of trial with a set of children who aren't going to be vaccinated. So what they do is, so the federal advisory committees that keep track of vaccine safety use a variety of systems to monitor the safety of vaccines. And so one is called the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which is pooled data from some of the largest HMOs across the country. There's also the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, which is the federal reporting system that is linked to the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that was set up in the 1980s in order to maintain the supply of vaccines by reducing the individual liability for pharmaceutical companies. So public health researchers and officials would argue that the monitoring systems that are in place have effectively demonstrated the overall safety of the childhood vaccine regime that we are under today. Many vaccine dissenters argue that there is an undercount and an underestimation of the number and the kind of injuries that are caused by multiple vaccines.
We're talking to Bernice Hausman on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of the book Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. She and a team of researchers looked at this more or less from the middle and attempted to go in with very open minds and turned up a lot of interesting information, as you're hearing. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Pro-vax, anti-vax, anywhere in the middle. Join us by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Larry in Ashland. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning. I commend the author. What a fabulous and thorough investigation of the subject. but my take on the whole thing is our society's basically going to hell in a handbasket. Vax, to me, anti-vax, is the same as Trump saying the Mexican gay Muslims are causing your problems in life, as evidenced by what the author focuses on. We need to understand the motivations of these cockamamie ideas. And I don't mind saying anti-vax is cockamamie. I don't want my grandson going to school where their children aren't vaccinated. That's horrible. And I don't need to be told that somehow I'm costing your job because I'm liberal about the people of Mexican and gay and Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a lot to take on there, Larry. But let's get Bernice come in here and talk about that part of it, though. The idea that people are nuts because they're anti-vax.
So one of the reasons why I think reframing is necessary is that it's very difficult to have a conversation that's productive if one side is calling the other nuts and we're sort of trading vilifying, shaming statements. I think we're at this really interesting moment in United States history, even world history, where we have lost a sense of how to have civil conversations about what it means when we disagree. And in a democracy, we need to figure out how to not only have conversations, but to make decisions and have laws. And so if vaccination is a very interesting and important thing to consider in light of this problem, because vaccines are not just medical treatments, but they're subject to law and public health law, and therefore they affect all of us.
You really do take on the idea in the book that vaccine fears are a problem of belief. And so if not that, then what?
Well, so in part they are, but one of the things that where that comes out in the book is this notion that that this sort of heterogeneous set of concerns about vaccines that we see in the reported on in the news media in the 1980s and 1990s become in the early years of 2000 a focus in the media on parental belief and especially wrong belief, right? So that the people who are have concerns about vaccines believe the wrong things, and therefore the way to address the problem is to teach them to believe in the right things. So that historical shift has creates a situation in which now anybody who has concerns about vaccines is participating in a set of wrong beliefs, the solution to which is to teach them how to believe correct things. Well, that basically ignores the potential legitimacy of concerns that people have about vaccinations, about vaccines as they're exist today and as they're developed for the future, and sets up a situation in which a whole group of people who have a variety of beliefs are in fact vilified as being stupid or gullible or scientifically illiterate. And again, that's not a good ground on which to actually address the concerns that people have and address the problems that public health has in addressing infectious disease when there are some people who dissent from vaccination.
Now, to the media role in this, which gets a fair amount of space in the book, I mean, the fact is that we're talking about media that may sound like they're questioning the motivations of the anti-vax people, but these are some of the same media outlets that did things like air the documentary about DPT vaccine roulette. What was that, in the 90s?
No, that was in the 80s, actually, yeah. 1982. Yeah, so I think that it's interesting because some popular work has vilified the media for somehow promoting vaccine dissent by sort of a both sides perspective, right? But more recently, what I've seen actually is sort of inadequate reporting that doesn't actually address the complexity of vaccine dissent. So early in this year, when measles cases were on the rise in this country, there was this immediate. Every single article talked about anti-vaxxers and the sort of misinformation that was spread by anti-vaxxers. So that we got the sense that all communities that were having outbreaks of measles, it was because people had this ideological opposition to vaccination. And then it turned out that they're, you know, like eventually reporting kind of caught up to the complexity of these situations. And it turned out that, of course, the story was always more complicated. The communities in New York State that had very, very high rates of measles had a variety of reasons for disrupted relationships with public health. They also had a pretty direct access to Ukraine, where a lot of cases were and that were coming to the United States from the Ukraine. So the story was always more complex.
I think one of the most effective parts of the book, Bernice, is where you point out that vaccine resistance doesn't take place in a world where there's just that subject matter. Other things get into the public consciousness, like the AIDS epidemic and what's happened there. The vaccinations for soldiers in the Gulf War, 9/11 and anthrax. And so you've got all this going on. And then you got the likes of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. jumping into the debate. What did he add to it?
Well, so he published an article in 2005 called Deadly Immunity, and that article was published online at Salon.com, and it came out in Rolling Stone magazine. It has since been taken off the Salon website, I believe. It's interesting when you do research on stuff like this, and when you start out, you find things on the web, and then they disappear. but that article took a look at something called the Simpson-Wood Conference, which was a gathering of public health experts and officials at a conference center, I believe, in Georgia called this. The name was Simpson-Wood, and they were discussing that conference was looking at thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative that has been used as a preservative in vaccines since, I'm going to say, the 1920s or 1930s. And so, and that came under increasing scrutiny in the 1990s in relation to a variety of concerns about environmental contamination. And so the Kennedy basically, it fits with Kennedy's profile. He was an environmentalist lawyer. And so his concern was that this conference and the minutes from this conference demonstrate a cover-up on the part of the government concerning the safety of thimerosal in vaccines. Now, thimerosal has been removed from vaccines by the FDA using the precautionary principle. They've never identified an actual health threat, but they decided to remove it from everything except for vaccines that are have multiple doses in a single vial, which I think are just some forms of flu vaccine. In any event, the children no longer receive thimerosal in vaccines as a result of that decision by the FDA.
Let's take another call here. We have Elizabeth and Eureka on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say, first of all, that I'm very glad to hear your viewpoint, and I think it contrasts with what I usually hear on radio, which is about all I listen to. And I oppose what the other caller said. I did not vote for Trump, and I'm distrustful when I hear what sounds like public relations stories on NPR. They don't sound to me like they're balanced at all. And I agree with the second and third things you listed about why people are anti-vaxxers. The distrust of Big Pharm is one of them, and I don't think people realize how much money Big Pharm has and how much it influences our government. And I don't think that the people like the FDA, I don't think they're protecting us anymore from these things. So I'm just very glad to hear your point of view on the air. Thank you for being on the air.
All right. Thank you, Elizabeth. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Let's take another call from Lizelle in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I had a couple of questions around the politics of this. I recall, and Jeffrey, maybe you recall better, because I heard on the Jefferson Exchange a few months ago an interview with somebody, and it wasn't a program that I was able to listen to the entirety of, but you were speaking with somebody who had been archiving certain things on social media, and this guest spoke to the fact that at some point, they had gone through their catalog and removed all posts that were found out to have been posted by Russian bots. And they discovered that both sides of the vaccine conversation were taken off, like 90% of those posts were taken off when they removed the Russian bot posts.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that so fascinating because as a person who actually is not on social media and somebody who has always considered myself to be very liberal and also somebody who is not, I don't vaccinate my kids, I've noticed how the conversation has shifted so dramatically in the last 4, 5, maybe 6 years, where people who are considered themselves to be liberal, it's suddenly become this anti-liberal thing to be anti-vax. So, and it just feels like the possibility is there that it's part of, without sounding too conspiracy theorist, it may be part of this Russian disinformation thing and turning us against ourselves because it is so heated. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay, thanks for that. And yeah, we did talk to David Broniatowski last year or earlier this year about the research he did into finding out that the Russian bots are generally out there spreading a lot of misinformation, basically just trying to create some false equivalency. So that's what that conversation was about. And Bernice, you can take on the rest of that question.
Well, it is really interesting because I think that what it demonstrates is that there is, you know, I argue there's a real controversy around vaccines in this country. It's a social controversy, and then it makes a lot of sense that if there is an interest on the part of the Russians to destabilize and sort of kind of create more rifts and schisms among people in this country, that they would choose topics on which there's an already existing set of values and beliefs that are pretty inflammatory and then exploit that. So that makes a lot of sense to me. I think the other really interesting thing, Lizelle, that you brought up is the way that the politics on vaccination kind of worked themselves out. There were a number of efforts in state legislatures this year to restrict exemptions to vaccine mandates, and some of them succeeded in New York State. They succeeded, I believe, in Washington State. There is now no longer an exemption for measles vaccine. Maine, I think, also passed one. But what's interesting about it is that, by and large, the efforts to end exemption, non-medical exemptions to vaccination mandates were put forward in legislatures by Democrats, and the resistance was Republicans, and in large part on the question of questions of freedom and liberty and individuality. And so I think that is a really interesting development that we are starting to see along, you know, kind of party lines, a set of efforts with respect to vaccination. I find it troubling because I think that this issue should not be a partisan issue, and I think that it demonstrates the way that I don't know how to say this well, but it's almost like everything now is becoming sort of aligned with political parties, mm-hmm. which makes it more and more difficult to have a civil conversation about the values that undergird our position.
Oh, so if an issue gets associated yes or no with a political party on either side of that, it just gets more intractable.
Yes, and then it's also the discussion around it becomes more inflammatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just refreshing my memory that in Oregon there was a measure that had enough votes to pass that would have closed off most of the non-medical exemptions, and the governor removed it from consideration as part of a deal with Republicans to end a walkout over a separate bill. So that's what happened in Oregon. Let's take a call from Al in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange.
So thank you for taking my call. You know, I have a question. I don't know if you covered it or not. But recently I heard there's in one of the islands in the Pacific where, I mean, a bunch of people died because of measles. And I have heard argument that anti-vaccines use, which is they say that the MMR, which is measles, mumps, and rubella, that the problem is having them all together, and they needed to be separated, and that's what's making the problem even worse. So I would like to know if you have anything about that.
All right. Thanks very much, Al. Appreciate that. Yeah, MMR, you mentioned earlier, that it's much bigger than MMR and autism, but go ahead, Bernice.
Well, so the situation you're talking about, Al's speaking of, is in Samoa right now, where they do have a very significant outbreak of measles. They've had a number of children die. It's very serious. What's really interesting about that context is that a few years ago, there was a case where two children died consequent to their MMR vaccination because the nurses who delivered the vaccines improperly mixed the vaccines with a muscle relaxant rather than water. And as a result, confidence in the vaccine program plummeted, and about only 30% of children in Samoa have been vaccinated against the measles as a result of that. So this is a very specific incident in which a local population lost confidence in a vaccine program due to medical error. But what it shows me is the fragility of these vaccine regimes. There is enough concern and enough dissent that is sort of available in the world today that an incident like this one of medical error can lead to the kind of complete disruption of a vaccine program. So that tells us something very important about public health and about vaccinations within overall preventative health programs, and that vaccine programs are not robust.
I was not surprised to find Dr. Paul Offit in your book. He's a huge promoter of vaccines and has been on several times on the exchange to talk about his books. But he comes in for some criticism in your book, and I just wonder if you think he's making vaccine skepticism worse.
I think he is not careful rhetorically about the way he makes his arguments, and appears to want to be inflammatory, which to me is not an approach that actually, for the one thing, addresses people's concerns, and for a second point, treats them civilly. I was at a meeting in Virginia with a lot of public health people in 2011, and Paul Offit said that the problem with vaccination resistance was mothers with PhDs who knew too much for their own good. And I was sort of horrified as a mother with a PhD, with my graduate student who was getting a PhD and would become a mother eventually. It was an incredibly disrespectful comment to make, I think, about the kind of knowledge that women bring as mothers to their mothering practices. And the notion that women getting an education are a danger to their children. That's a very old theme in American culture.
Yes, it is. About a minute left here, Bernice. Do you see a way forward? I mean, it sounds like you're seeing battle lines hardening, as they do in so many things in America. And if we treat this as culture instead of psychology, is there a different approach and perhaps a different outcome?
Well, that's what I would hope. You can't solve this problem by dumping more scientific evidence into the public sphere, which appears to be the sort of standard public health and biomedical approach. But one thing I think is really interesting, I've been doing a lot of these interviews, and people keep asking me, how can we communicate better? How can we have these conversations? And I feel like that has been it's been very gratifying to me that that's one of the messages that comes out of my book, but also it feels like people want to have different conversations around issues of grave disagreement in their communities. So that feels like a start to me.
All right. So we may finally be getting to some point of beginning to be able to talk to each other about it. That would be nice. We have explored both sides here in the book, as Bernice Hausman does. The book is called Anti-Vax, Reframing the Vaccination Controversy. And Bernice is the Department of Humanities Chair at Penn State's College of Medicine in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.